Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Vartha Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyapa and I have with me Abhishek Paul and Nirav Kanodra. Together we'll bring you the news and events of the week that was. This week we're discussing the updates from the Israel-Hamas war that is ongoing. Also we have the Cricket World Cup that's happening in India. The India-UK FTA negotiations are in the news again and they are in advanced stages. Also, while addressing the International Olympic Committee session at the GeoWorld Center, Prime Minister Modi made some interesting remarks. He said that India will bid for the 2036 Olympics, right? All of this and more on this Bharat Vartha Weekly. If this is your first time, we publish episodes on politics, policy and culture a couple of times a week. Do follow or subscribe to us on your favorite platform to stay updated. All right, let's get on with the news for the week. The war between Israel and Hamas has escalated quickly in just over a week. Last week, a day after the initial attack by Hamas, Israel declared a state of war in the country with full support from the opposition parties. Israel has issued an evacuation order to the citizens of Gaza to move south, warning them of air and land strikes in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made several statements and doubled down, saying that the IDF will only intensify these attacks and take every measure to eliminate all terrorist activities in the Gaza Strip. Nirav, is this the start of a World War III?
So, now we don't know. See, there's been a few conflicts. You had first the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict in the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Then you had Ukraine and Russia. And now this is Israel versus Hamas. I'm saying it Israel versus Hamas because it is against a terrorist entity. It's not versus Gaza. We don't know how this escalates. One is early. So few things you already mentioned that they've given an evacuation notice. So Gaza Strip is like a small strip of land about 36 kilometers by like max 12 and minimum 6 kilometers in width. And the northern part of Gaza Strip is the Gaza City. So I think that's where they expect a lot of the Hamas terrorists to be held in. They're telling people to evacuate to the southern side. And they're trying to evacuate US citizens who are stuck inside. A lot of them are like peacekeeping workers or people with like Doctors Without Borders, etc. And they've cut out water and electricity. So they're making it difficult. They are saying that unless Hamas surrenders, they won't return this. And there's a lot of backlash both sides. There's a lot of anti-Israel demonstrations all over the world. So this can be like a social rift within those countries. You've seen like in London, in a lot of European cities, in a lot of American cities, you've seen anti-Israel protests like in Harvard. And then there are a lot of companies which have like retracted offers from students who signed these petitions. Maybe not like a hot war, but definitely getting people divided. That has been the case. Early intelligence reports say that Iran wasn't really involved in this attack. But there is reports that $6 billion, which was frozen for oil payments made by South Korea, that was going to be unfrozen in exchange for some 5 American citizens detained by Iran. So I think that also could have played a part. So now if Iran gets involved, that would escalate violence all over the Middle East. So I think at least you'll have a bigger regional conflict. But let's see, hopefully, fingers crossed. Hopefully you see, I think this is going to be longer than most people expect. Just like nobody expected Russia-Ukraine war to go on for so long. I think they will divide Gaza into like Gaza City and the northern part and the southern part. Israeli army will try and like have full control of the southern part, and there's going to be like street guerrilla warfare. They've mobilized 530,000 soldiers. That is Israel's population of 7 million, right? Like it's almost like 8% of their population is going in the army. So I think that's going to be tough. It's going to take a long time, and hopefully there is a quick resolution of this acceptable by both sides. And politically, Golda Meir was the prime minister of Israel in 73 when the Yom Kippur war broke off. And that was an intelligence failure. And later on, she had to resign. Maybe Netanyahu, unless he comes out and Hamas is totally destroyed, or the terrorist group, like a lot of the leaders are captured or imprisoned or dead, it'll be very difficult for him to stay on in power after. Right now, they have a unity government for this war. But after the war is done, maybe he might have to step down or take responsibility of this attack. So let's see. I think there are more things escalating. But I think the bigger problem is the social rift. See, this has become very difficult in all places, in like workplaces. People are scared to voice out their opinions. There's a cancel culture. There is a lot of, I stand against terrorism very clearly. But people are now worried about how is it interpreted, who is listening to it, etc. And I think this in itself is kind of like a social division of society. I think that is also like a big problem. World War III, who knows? Maybe, maybe not. And I think next one, what people are, a lot of people are speculating is, will there be some sort of China aggression in Taiwan? Because you see, US military will be stretched. They were helping out arms and ammunition to Ukraine, which they have paused for now. They're helping out Israel. So now would they be stretched so that they may not be able to respond quickly? And the joker in the pack is always North Korea. So nobody's talking about them right now. So I'm just highlighting it that who knows? Who knows? So yes, I think the world's like focus on world leaders' attention is very divided and scattered. So yeah, hopefully things resolve properly soon.
Yeah, a few different points before I pass it on to Abhishek. This comes at a time when, you know, the Saudis were really trying their diplomatic efforts in the region and so on, right? And there is this supposed perspective that, you know, maybe the Iranians did not want, Sunni Saudis to kind of succeed and intervened to cause the chaos that they did, right? That and obviously the $6 billion unfrozen was good, enablement support for the cause. Certainly, it felt like, you know, the scale of attack and the complexity of attack, it couldn't have just been planned, in a few days or few weeks, right? I mean, 2,500 fighters entering the state is just, it's crazy. Abhishek, I mean, do you think that China will do something about Taiwan in this window?
Yeah, I think that's a very real possibility now. Because obviously the Chinese would be looking in their own calculations, right, as to what is the most optimum time where they would make military moves. And I think whether it is Taiwan or whether it is even our borders, right, like, there is a time to be really watchful, for example, for India, right, on all fronts, because this kind of an attack that Hamas has carried out also gives a lot of encouragement and motivation to jihadi elements in the subcontinent, right, wherever they are located. So I was listening to a very excellent podcast by Smita Prakash with ex-military people, like General Shukla and Colonel Hani Bakshi, right? And both of them talked about how, you know, you could sort of possibly see lone wolf attacks on Indian cities and things like that, possibly in the coming, time. Because this is like a huge boost to all jihadist elements in the subcontinent, whether they are in Pakistan, Afghanistan, or, potentially, even inside the country, right? So I think one of the stories they narrated was how, we know about this 18 people from Kerala who joined ISIS and all, right? And so they said that, there was one guy going on a bike and some random police guy stopped him near our Brigade Road or Cantonment Road somewhere in Bangalore, right? And that guy just blurted out that he's going to deliver these supplies to some boys who are joining ISIS, right? Like such a random, and the police guy was like stunned, so he quickly called his seniors, and after that, they sort of discovered what is happening. So the total collapse of Israel, the much wanted Israeli intelligence, right, whether it is Mossad or whatever other organizations they have is also something to be studied, right? Like, this is a failure of catastrophic proportions, right? And yeah, I think the world is obviously in a very precarious situation right now, I would say, because the US is now totally stretched on many different fronts, right? Which basically gives countries like Iran or China or North Korea to, you know, pursue any sort of agenda. They think probably this is like the most optimum moment you could find, right? I mean, obviously, right now there is some sort of conflict happening in Syria right now. The U.S. Secretary of State Blinken is visiting Qatar, and Qatar is hosting Hamas leaders simultaneously. Like, it's kind of hard to imagine, right? Exactly this sort of scale in which things are kind of screwed up, right? Like, but the most in some ways, one of the most disturbing things I have seen the last week is what Nirav mentioned, right? The kind of societal divisions you're seeing openly in the West now. In Sydney, you had pro-Palestine protesters or activists, whatever you call, openly supporting Hamas and saying, you know, like, gas the Jews and stuff openly in front of the Opera House. Then you have like had massive support for the Hamas or anti-Israel sort of protests in London, in various cities in the United States. You've had a stabbing incident already in France. I saw some pictures of Jewish houses getting marked in Germany. Like, that is crazy, right? Like, it's like you're back in the 1940s. So it's a very precarious situation. I can't say anything of this is surprising to me, because although the mainstream media has been sort of trying to hide it or trying to overlook it or being on the side of, you know, pro-immigration rhetoric of the left in the West, I think a lot of people have been flagging it off as well, right, over the last couple of decades. People like Douglas Murray, etc., whom you must have read or heard, right, have constantly pointed out things of how things are going out of control, right? Because you are not really looking at the quality of people or the type of people you're letting into your country. And so now I don't think any of it is really surprising, but maybe this is kind of waking up a lot of people as well, right? The other thing, as Nirav said, is obviously this cancel culture thing, right? Like, that is going to now become an issue with students of elite universities, because, like, just imagine Harvard students coming out in support of Hamas activities, right? Like, which employer would like that? At least the corporate sector hasn't gone that crazy yet, right? So now people will have to be very careful either way, right? Like, what are you saying in public, what statements you endorse and things like that. So yeah, I think quite a eventful time, but quite a, as Nirav said, a very divisive time, especially in the West right now.
Yeah, this whole period of somewhat, you know, like a Pax Americana period post 9/11, right, that certainly has been shattered, I feel. Right, that, I think, you know, not having maybe any major terrorist attacks and so on. The last one I can recall is 26/11. I don't know if anything of that scale has happened in a major city in the world. Right, I think that kind of lulled people into the real threat of jihadi terrorism, right? Which I think India has been going on and on about. Right, that is something that we have to take notice of. So. Yeah, troubling times for sure, I suppose. So, all right, moving on, the Cricket World Cup has been happening in the country, and there was some controversy last week. The BCCI has gotten into hot water for over-the-top hospitality given to the Pakistani team. Ex-users posted videos of the grand welcome given to the players from the terrorist state, and slammed the BCCI and pointed out that India had lost 3 soldiers to their terrorists only a few days before. In true Indian fashion, hashtag boycott India Pak match and boycott BCCI started trending a couple of hours later. Nirav, what do you make of this? It didn't deter people from watching the match, certainly. I mean, there were some 3.5 crore people concurrent, I suppose.
So I think, I totally agree that, India is hosting the World Cup and it should treat all 9 visiting teams the same. I don't think there's anything special about Pakistan. It's a middle-ranked team. Their ODI ranking is quite high, but like still, is there one of the 9 teams? I think all of them, we do believe in Atithi Devo Bhava, so but treat all of them equally. I think they went a bit over the top for welcoming them and having a whole song and dance show, etc. at the beginning, which was not there even for the opening game. Had it been a part of an opening ceremony, it might have been appropriate. So I think it was there in a wonderful stadium. It's a great win for India, so great. But it is one of the 9 matches which India has to win. I'm hoping India wins all 9 and then wins the semis and the finals. So it is just one of the other competitors. I feel like in the World Cup, we've reached like 3 games out of 9, 1/3 the way of the group stage. I think the teams are in like 3 buckets. So there are 5 teams, which I think are the most likely. 4 out of the 5 will make the semis. So that's India, Australia, England, South Africa, New Zealand. South Africa, New Zealand have started really well. But these are the best 5 teams. Then you have the middle of the pack team, which is Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh. I would put them there. Who can be a spoiler for the other teams making the semis. A loss to like one of these could kind of spoil your chances. They can win a few games, but in a long league phase, it's a little bit difficult for them to make it to the semis, I feel. And then there are like complete no-hopers, which is Afghanistan and Bangladesh have no chance, realistic chance of making it to the semis. But I think that's where you have to keep your net run rate very high, because I think net run rate will play a part. So looking into the consideration, it's a middle run team which India has kind of beaten. Fine, no big deal. Yes, we've got some 7-0 record and there's a historical record, etc. But that is okay. I think for this, great starts have been made by New Zealand, South Africa and India. And Australia and England have kind of not done as well as they would have liked, but it's a long group stage. So that is there. Apart from this boycott, BCCI boycott, I think a lot of people have been unhappy. I think the way the whole ticketing thing has been, it has been difficult for NRIs or foreigners to buy tickets because you have to go to the local place stadium to be able to collect tickets. So I think that's not been very well organized, not been very well done. That would have boosted a lot of tourism, a lot of inflows. A lot of NRIs are being able to buy tickets from scalpers and in black, or some event management companies have bought it and then they're reselling it. But all aside, I think while obviously I expected a lot more from the organization, the World Cup so far has been very interesting. It's been good. It's been interesting. I think the cricket is of very high quality and we've got like it's going to get tough. I am very happy with like New Zealand and South Africa doing very well. Australia and England, who keep on doing typically well, they haven't started well, but like, let's see. And as I said, I'm hoping that India wins all the 9 group games and the semis and the finals. And India has got a very good schedule for itself with alternate matches with a strong and a weak team. Only thing is India is playing in 9 different venues. A lot of the other countries, they play 2 successive games at one particular venue, then they move on to the next place. So, for example, I think now Pakistan will play next 2 games in Chennai, or like New Zealand is playing 2 games in Dharamshala, one of them with India. One. So, that makes it a little easier or less travel for other teams. Would have been great for traveling fans if you had like a lot of English Barmy army or the Australian fans coming in. So, they can only visit 4 or 5 cities and then they can see a lot of the games. Or like in one city, they can get 2 games in the same city and do a bit of tourism and other things around. So that has been the disappointing part. But the cricket and the quality of cricket and the results have been pleasing for me. So fingers crossed, I think it remains a great event. And
Abhishek, a lot of flack for the organizers, right? I mean, from the where the tickets have been sold to, you know, even some of the ground facilities and so on. What seems to have gone wrong with that?
Yeah, I think the biggest disaster is probably the ticketing one. And we don't really even have answers as to what has gone wrong, because obviously the BCCI controls the information also quite tightly, right? And none of the media houses actually have any credible story as to what went wrong. Because see, what can happen in a country like India is you have obviously massive demand. So you can say put out all the tickets and then they get sold and a lot of people are unhappy. But that would mean that everything in the inventory is sold. But what we are seeing is that it's not clear as to how many tickets are being put out and whether the entire stock of inventory is being put out, right? Number one. Number two, you have typically a sort of number of tickets that are earmarked for association members, right? In every state or city of each stadium. And then those people either distribute it or sell it. But that number is usually tend to be minimized, right, for events like the World Cup. You know, there's no sort of clarity on that. But I think what kind of shocked people is this sort of ad hoc bringing out further tickets, you know, at random intervals, right? Like suddenly another batch of ticket is released, let's say 5 days in advance of a match, right? Like you have already shown that it is kind of sold out. Then, you know, where was this batch of tickets lying, right? The other one probably equally bad has been the scheduling, right? Like they didn't sort of announce schedule just before a few months, right? Typically it is done 10, 12 months before an event. So, you know, people can plan. Typically foreign team supporters can plan and, you know, visit India for watching the match and other tourism purposes, right? So that is obviously another failing. The other one which kind of has surprised me is the quality of outfield related complaints. It so far I've seen it only from the Dharamshala ground, which was quite not really great. And hopefully I think the other grounds which are yet to host a match like Kolkata, Mumbai, Bangalore, I think generally the outfields are good here. So that should be, hopefully, you know, fingers crossed, no more complaints to come on that front. But yeah, pretty embarrassing to have, you know, one of your, because you see, we have so many stadiums in the country, right? But we've chosen only, I think, 10 stadiums to host World Cup matches. So you would expect that these 10 stadiums would be in, you know, top condition. So yeah, I think these are the main sort of issues with the organization so far. The other one obviously is the whole unofficial opening ceremony that happened yesterday. Luckily, I would say due to rights issues, it did not get broadcast on television, because I think that would have caused even more outrage, right? So I think the fact that it did not get telecasted gave some people satisfaction, thinking that, you know, is there outrage on Twitter that stopped it? The fact seems to be that it is because the television broadcaster did not procure rights for the music and stuff. So due to the lack of that license, they did not broadcast it. But any which way, right? I think at least it's good that, you know, they did not broadcast it on TV.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like we're hosting a Cricket World Cup, you know. Maybe people have moved on from cricket to other sports, or I don't know, right? I mean, it certainly was a lot more hyped in 96 and 2011 for sure, right? But it's definitely good that, you know, the team is doing well.
I actually agree to that point. I think I clearly remember my cousin's kids are not too excited about it, the Cricket World Cup. I was speaking to them on phone and they follow like European football. I'm hoping if India does very well in cricket, maybe there's a little more interest. So I was comparing like their age is similar to like what I was in 96, and you know, so either they're like kids are already like too much into like academics and all of those, or like video games or like other things. But yeah, so maybe hopefully it inspires another next generation of cricketers.
Yeah,
I think 96 was like peak Sachin Tendulkar era, and 2011 was the last of Sachin Tendulkar. So both of them had a very big connection with
yes
where we were in the journey of Tendulkar, right?
Yeah, so true. Maybe directly correlated to Sachin's playing, for sure. All right, talks between India and the UK on a free trade deal have reached an advanced stage, as negotiators have significantly narrowed differences on key issues. Among the issues on which the two sides have narrowed divergences are business mobility, Scotch whisky, and automobiles, increasing hopes for a breakthrough within the next 2 weeks. A few unresolved matters like work visas, tariffs on key items, intellectual property rights, digital trade, professional services, and rules of origin will require a political nod from both the Prime Ministers, Prime Minister Modi and Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. The UK has been reluctant to go beyond current level of 100,000 work visas issued to Indians annually. The Indian side suggested as a compromise that the number could be increased while reducing the duration of visas. Nirav, we've been talking about the India-UK FTA for quite a while. When do you think it will finally happen?
So I think basically you've correctly highlighted the key issues, right? So I think key issues, one is they want to reduce the import duties on manufactured goods, so like automobiles, but also like Scotch whiskey. That is pretty critical. And Indians are reluctant because India has a whole domestic alcohol business, which could lose a lot of market share or competitiveness, right? So you have local single malt whiskies like Amrut and John Paul, and you have like a lot of the other alcohol manufacturers in the country. So that is one key issue which India is trying to negotiate. So Britain wants it, but India is pushing back. India wants more than 100,000 visas annually. Now compare this, UK population is about 70 million or 7 crore, 7 crore and change. US is 33.5 crore or 34 crores. And US gives 85,000 H1Bs overall and some similar number L1 visas. And so 100,000 visas will be like a big number anyways. So I think, yes, people will talk about these things. Maybe they'll say about trying and increasing it over a period of time. And India is saying to reduce the import duties on Scotch whiskies over a period of time. So maybe that's some sort of a compromise. We could see this deal happening soon. I think like in a month's time, if these are the key issues being resolved. See, I think once this FTA gets done, there is like a massive multiplier effect. So India and UK are both about $3.5 trillion economies. India is a little bit bigger than UK now. But both are similar, but they're very different. So size is the same. UK is 70 million people, but they are 20 times as rich as Indians. India is 20 times the number of people, but like 5% as wealthy as UK, right? And so there's a lot of complementary things. They are a very big financial services hub. They could use a lot of support services with the FTA, especially on data, etc. It can help a lot of outsourcing activity to Indian firms. Also, like in terms of manufactured goods, I think one key that has been highlighted as well. One key thing is Royal Enfield motorcycles. That was Royal Enfield was a British company which had a plant in India. Then after independence, etc., that company sold their business to Eicher Motors. The parent company actually went bankrupt, and Eicher Motors again acquired the parent company back. And they've tried revive manufacturing in the UK as well. And they're doing, but now you could see a lot more auto component exports, automobile exports. Just like Royal Enfield, maybe you could see Mahindra and Tata also export some of their SUVs. Like they import Korean and Japanese cars. So maybe these ones as well. And the opportunity is tremendous. There is obviously there's going to be a lot of backlash, and we need to do it very quickly now. This window is closing fast. So India has elections next year. UK also has elections next year. With the current issues about like energy prices, inflation, etc., it's going to be very difficult for any incumbent to be re-elected in like Europe or UK. So Rishi Sunak might find it very difficult. A lot of things can change in a year, but might find it difficult to be re-elected. Politically, Labour is kind of attacking him that Rishi Sunak's wife is Indian citizen. His father-in-law was one of the co-founders of Infosys. They have almost like greater than 500 million pounds worth of Infosys shares. So he's got a vested interest. So there's going to be a lot of backlash. But the Conservatives have a majority right now. So you have to do it now. I think after that, the Labour Party might be very anti-India. Already the Labour Party is a little more leaning towards Pakistan versus India versus the Conservatives. So I think... given the situation, it is sensible for both to reach compromise. I think these are the last two topics of like the duties on imported goods and alcohol and work visas. And surely some sort of compromise can be reached. If done, they were saying they wanted to do it before October end. Hopefully, we can get it done. And this will be another successful FTA. We've got one with Australia. We have existing old FTAs with ASEAN and Korea and Japan, but like those are being like renegotiated as well. And this helps like India in every way. So India, everybody's trying to put China plus one strategy. So India is one of the winners in that. There are four or five countries, Vietnam, Mexico, Indonesia, etc. But so India is like assembling iPhones, for example. Now those can be exported to UK easily. Without duties, right? Under the FTA. So you've got a big market, you've got a rich market, you have like cheap labor, you have like high income, so that can be complementary. And I think this will also set a template. EU probably is, there are a lot more pitfalls, but if they see UK has done it, see UK needs somebody like India with an FTA because they've gone away from the EU. But now if EU sees that there's a very visible benefit for the UK, then EU also might come on the table and agree on some kind of the difficult points with India. And the FTA with Canada is in deep freeze till India's elections in 2024 and Canada's in 2025. So who knows? I think till like Justin Trudeau is there, it's almost unlikely. And maybe he wins again. We don't know. Or maybe his party wins again. We don't know. So he may step down, but his party may win and there might be another Liberal Party Prime Minister. So this is one opportunity to show a quick win. And I think you have, like I'm hoping, fingers crossed, I'm hoping this deal is rammed through. No deal is perfect. I think that's a highlight of a successful agreement, that it's not in particularly in favor of one party or another. You know, that if both are like slightly unhappy, then it's a good agreement. If one side is happy and the other is unhappy, it's a bad agreement. So, fingers crossed. I've been following this for a long time. And I'm hoping we do another episode with the Conservative Friends of the Commonwealth. They've done a lot of work over here as well. Hopefully, fingers crossed, we get a deal done. But I've always seen, like I've been disappointed many times earlier. So, if it doesn't happen, all fair and good. But... hopefully we see it by the end of this month, if not the end of this year.
Oh, let's hope for that. Also, I mean, on another note, we have three massive elections coming up next year, right? I mean, India, US and UK. So that should be interesting times for sure. I wonder if it's happened before that way. So, all right, moving on. Prime Minister Modi is all set to inaugurate the country's first fastest urban transit system, the RapidX in Delhi NCR. The 82-kilometer long Delhi Meerut RapidX network aims to become fully operational by 2025. The deployment of RRTS corridors, initially conceived during UPA 2 administration, aims to reduce travel time between Delhi and major cities within the national capital region. Also, on the sports front, Prime Minister Modi on Saturday announced that India will be bidding to host the Olympics in 2036. Prime Minister Modi made a promise to the country saying India will leave no stone unturned in its bid to host the Olympics. Abhishek, I mean, both very, very interesting, right? Infrastructure and sports, something that we have a lot to be optimistic about.
Right. So firstly, talking about the RapidX project, right? So this seems to be something very exciting and useful for commuters in the NCR region, right? So they are working on three routes: Delhi Meerut, Delhi Alwar, and Delhi Panipat. And the first one that is being inaugurated right now is a part of the overall Delhi Meerut route, right? And overall, this route will cover 82 kilometers, and I think they are starting off with a 17 kilometer stretch of that. So I think this is excellent. This RapidX train is supposed to reach, top speeds of around 160 to 180 kilometers per hour, right? Which will drastically sort of cut down commute times. And so I think this is yet another accelerant for the whole economic development of that NCR slash Uttar Pradesh, Haryana, Rajasthan region. And so I think this is a really great sort of initiative. Coming to the announcement on the bidding for 2036 Olympics, I think that's yet another massive step if we are able to, successfully organize one. I think like the Beijing Olympics was a massive success for China in some ways, right? Because it helped up build up so much infrastructure, etc. There. And so whichever city gets it, right, in India, I mean, it's up to each municipality or city to basically do the planning and bidding, because ultimately Olympics are awarded to cities and not necessarily countries, right? So I think potentially I can see Ahmedabad being one of the leading contenders for India. I can see the NCR region, right? If you take because we have hosted the Commonwealth Games in Delhi in the last decade as well, right? So there's a lot of infrastructure there. So I would say these two are probably the top contenders from India. I would not be surprised if even Hyderabad, for example, joins the race. So I would say this is probably a great opportunity for India to, showcase its capabilities and develop its capabilities, right? And with our population, you are not going to end up with the white elephant problem, right? Which, let's say, a country like Qatar had, where they built so many stadiums and they can't really use it. For us, with our population, everything is going to be useful in the long run, right? So that danger is not there. It's more about, scaling up and executing at that kind of a scale, global scale. So, for example, like the G20 hosting this year was yet another sort of successful, execution of a global event, right? Which is where, this sort of tardy hosting of the World Cup kind of stings, right? Because we have the capability of really, doing world-class events in India, right? And we have been doing so. That's a bit of an anomaly, but yeah, I think it will not be easy. Obviously, there will be many cities around the world that will bid along with the Indian cities. So yeah, let's hope that it is sort of planned well, and our bids are really competitive and compelling.
Yeah, I think this could also advance our sports facilities infrastructure by a great deal for sure, right? And not just for sports, I think in general, I mean, city infrastructure, state infrastructure could get better as well in
A lot of
preparation.
boost,
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. And so, yeah, just adding to that, right? If like India does get the 2036 Olympics, I want to compare it. Like 1988, Seoul had its Olympics. It was announcing to the world that it's gone from like a developing country to like a middle income or developed country. 2008 was China's moment. So maybe like 2036, is it India's moment? I was hoping it'll be sooner, but We got 24 Olympics in Paris, 28 in LA, and then 32 in Brisbane. So hopefully that's there as well. And second is, think about a 10-year-old kid today. You know that you're going to have Olympics in 2036 in your country. There's going to be a lot of preparation. There's going to be a lot of focus. So we'll be taking part in a lot of events. And hopefully that leads to like a lot more medals. See, we've seen an improvement. The Olympic gold quest. We've seen an improvement through Commonwealth Games, Asian Games, the last Olympics. So we won 7 medals, individual gold and javelin. And we need more. And we should like have like a regular steady progress. So I think making a bid for it, the Prime Minister putting his weight behind, that is fantastic. The sports infrastructure which comes in, that will be fantastic. By then, we'll have a lot better urban infra. We are trying, like all cities, Indian cities are crumbling right now. But like for the Commonwealth Games, they really expanded Delhi metro network. So we get better urban infra in a few pockets of those cities. That makes tourism. That's an advertising for India, because that's an advertisement for all people coming and visiting India. So you have G20.
I just looked at the Wikipedia page. So it seems Mumbai has already confirmed that it is bidding. So that's interesting.
Hope so. So, and lastly, I just wanted to add on the RRTS. So I think it's a very nice, I think this should have been done long ago. See, NCR is like 5-6 cities around Delhi, and you've got a whole big network. And this allows like people to live further away, where so you will see better facilities, better urban infrastructure, maybe private developers and gated communities. But then you see a rise of commuter class. What you have like in mega cities like Tokyo or like New York and London, where a lot of people live in the suburbs and they commute into the city. And you will see, I would want similar kind of services. Hopefully, once the success of the NCR RRTS happens, you could have between like Mumbai, Pune, Nasik, and all the way like Palghar or Surat in Mumbai region. Maybe Ahmedabad, Baroda kind of RRTS, maybe Bangalore, Mysore, and like around there, maybe Chennai and Vellore, or like again surrounding cities. So this, the proof of concept that you could have rapid urban commuter trains, maybe 100-kilometer radius from the city center, which takes you about in an hour. The peak speeds can be whatever, but in an hour, you can travel about 100 kilometer, and then once you go into the city center, you take local urban transport, either like auto rickshaws or cabs or local metro. So that actually disperses population around. There's less pressure on other infrastructure amenities like schools, etc. And this template, hopefully, we can scale it up and like leads to better urbanization of the country.
No, something like this has to happen, right? I mean, I've been saying for years now that if you reduce the Bangalore-Mysore travel and, you know, perhaps be ambitious and crush it down to maybe like half an hour, 45 minutes, a lot of people will definitely move, right? Because in peak traffic, anywhere, you know, Bangalore commute is going to take you an hour or so. Right, and given the difference in real estate prices, given the environment and so many other things, right? Yeah, moving to Mysore is a no-brainer for a lot of folks, for sure. Yeah. All right, with that, we come to the end of this Bharat Vartha Weekly. Next week, we'll likely be hosting Daniel Boardman, the Canadian journalist who was in the news for his views on the whole India-Canada standoff. Other than that, let us know if there are people or topics that we should host and cover. We're at Bharat Vartha on all social media platforms. Do tweet to us or write to us, and we'll definitely take that into account. We'll see you next week. Plenty of news to cover as well. So from Abhishek, Nirav, and myself, thank you for joining us. Stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.